This is going to be a rather lengthy video. It's covering the weight control issues that people encounter when quitting smoking. Although, some of the weight control issues that we'll be discussing isn't just centered around quitting smoking weight gain. Weight gain is something that happens to a lot of people who never smoked a day in their life, over the years. So some of the principles I'm talking about here will be as applicable to them as it will be to people in smoking cessation programs. In smoking cessation programs, though, there's a couple of unique situations. One of them is some people almost allow themselves to eat everything in sight when they're quitting smoking, with the attitude they got to deal with quitting smoking now. They'll deal with this other thing later. The problem of doing this, the problem of using food as a substitution, is the problem that you're going to deal with later, if you do gain weight and then end up having to lose it. It's harder to lose weight in the long term than it is to quit smoking in the long term. Much harder, which is quite evident by the fact we have more former smokers in this country right now than actual current smokers, meaning over half the people who used to smoke have been able to successfully quit smoking. You do not see numbers like that with weight control issues. In fact, only 3% of people who lose weight in our country are able to keep it off over a long-term basis. So it kind of shows you it's a lopsided idea to work with the idea, well, I'll gain weight now and deal with it later, because the problem that you're going to develop is going to be harder to deal with than the problem that you're solving at this point in time. You have to be very careful when using food as a substitution. Now, you hear a lot of people who quit smoking and say, well, they didn't purposely eat more. In fact, their statement's going to be they didn't eat that much more, and yet they gained a lot of weight. I mean, there's people who gained 20 and 30 and 40 pounds who will swear to you they didn't eat that much more after they quit smoking. Now, let's understand something. These people, in all likelihood, are telling you the truth. They didn't eat that much more. What they did, though, is they ate a little bit more every single day. Every single day after they quit smoking, and those days started to add up. See, if you eat a little bit more on a daily basis, and you do not stop that pattern, you know, after the initial quitting process, well, that little bit of food over a lifetime could become a lot of food. In the slide presentation that I'm going to attach to this introductory commentary here, it'll discuss this. It'll show you how just eating 100 extra calories a day, what it could come back and do to you over a long-term basis if you continue that kind of pattern. It's important for people when they're first quitting smoking to try to work with the basis of not increasing their overall food consumption. They may have to redistribute when they eat their food, but that doesn't mean they have to eat more food. It may mean they have to break meals apart and snack in between those meals, using calories that would have been involved in the main meals, but using them at different points in the day. There's other videos already discussing this issue when we discuss blood sugar problems that people have when they quit smoking. But weight control is its own area, and there's not much I can really do in the following video, which is going to be earth-shattering information or something that's going to have great success with it. Generally, as I said, only 3% of people lose weight are able to keep it off. But most people are using programs that don't have a whole lot of chance of success. There's some very basic guidelines that a lot of people probably just don't know, which really can help with weight control. But it takes effort by the individual. It takes, again, self-control by the individual that they have to utilize for the rest of their life. The problem with most programs when it comes to weight control are people go on diets. And again, a diet is something people go on to lose weight. The problem is when they lose the weight, they will go off the diet. Again, the diet served its purpose. Well, that principle is where the failure rate is so high. Because if you're going to go on something on a temporary basis, well, that means you're going back to the eating pattern that made you overweight to start with. And at that point, it's pretty much that guaranteed kind of washout. It really is a matter of learning a new pattern of living. It's not just an eating issue. There's also an activity issue intertwined into this. It's a matter of picking up new patterns that are going to be conducive for losing weight, but also patterns that you're going to be able to stick with over the long term, which are conducive for keeping that weight off down the road. The attached video will be, I'm not sure the length because I'm still in the middle of filming it. I suspect it's going to probably be about a half an hour, and it really will cover general guidelines. And again, these are things that would be applicable to people who never smoked a day in their life wanting to lose weight, and also people who are quitting smoking, and also the people who have quit smoking and have let weight get out of hand now and now need to deal with it. One thing I want to point out up front, though, using weight as a reason for not quitting smoking is a mistake, or losing weight as a reason to go back to smoking is usually a bigger mistake. I've known numerous people who went back to smoking with the idea, if they just go back to smoking, they could lose all this weight they gained after they quit, who find out they're in for a bad, bad surprise. They don't lose the weight at times when they go back to smoking. Some people do. Some people all of a sudden seem like they get their eating under control. But I've known a lot of people who quit smoking, gained weight, and now relapsed to lose the weight and didn't. They also had problems that necessitated that they had to quit smoking. So they quit smoking again. And during that second quit, they gained a whole bunch of weight. Again, because every time they quit smoking, they do the same behaviors, the same mistakes that led to weight gain the first time, they repeat it, and then you'll see people gaining over and over again because they thought that if they just magically went back to smoking, the weight would come off, and then they deal with smoking again. It doesn't work that like that in many cases, and it's a dangerous game to play. So for people who are just quitting smoking, hopefully you'll be able to implement some of these steps so you can avoid that initial weight gain. Although I got to be careful now explaining something about initial weight gain. You will find some people who will eat no more the week they quit smoking, and all of a sudden they're up 3 or 4 or 5 pounds. And this gets scary because they start to think, oh my God, if I gain this weight in a week, I mean, what am I going to weigh in a month? What am I going to weigh in a year? The weight gain that people first get when they quit smoking, and I mean the very early time period, the first 2 weeks, there's a water retention effect that happens when you quit smoking. And many people will get bloated the week they are quitting smoking. This is water weight. This weight will come on very quickly, and it will go away very quickly. The weight gain that I'm dealing with here in the video isn't about this weight shift. That's a temporary situation. The weight gain we're talking about are the extra calories that are eaten on a day-by-day basis that turn into fat down the road. You eat a little bit more every single day, and there's going to be an accumulation of fat, and that's going to be the problem at hand. And it's important to try to minimize that from happening in the beginning. We do suggest people take juice the first 3 days, but we're talking about 3 days. We're not talking about a week. We're not talking about a month. We're not talking about a year. We're talking about helping to stabilize the blood sugar for a very short time period. Any other food that you are doing over a longer time period can come back to haunt you and be a problem. One of the suggestions that we often give to people when they quit smoking is, you know, munch on things like celery and carrots. I want to point something out. There's nothing magical in celery and carrots. There's nothing magical in celery and carrots that are going to take withdrawal away. But it's giving somebody something they can put in their mouth if they have to have something, but something that they will get tired of. The day will come. It may take a few weeks, but the day will come where you'll see a carrot and it'll be, get the carrot out of here. You don't want that carrot. It's not going to be like, oh man, I got to give up celery today. What do I need to replace it with? You'll be sick and tired of the product. That doesn't work with other kinds of foods. It doesn't work with cakes. It doesn't work with cookies. It doesn't work with candies. What you think you're going to do initially for a short-term period often becomes a long-term behavior pattern that will have problems associated with it. So we don't want people substituting food early on, the types of food that are going to give them problems getting off down the road. So again, there's nothing magical in the information I'm going to give you. Most of the times, the stuff that I do in the smoking programs, I really feel they're really concrete. They really can make or break an issue. It's understanding addiction. It's understanding not taking a puff. See, this is where dieting is trickier. This is where dieting is harder over a long-term basis. You always have to eat. You're going to have to eat the rest of your life. And now it's a matter of when you're eating too much. And smokers often have mechanisms in place where smoking did help control their eating in a few respects. One of them, again, is it raises their blood sugar and blood fat levels. It told people they ate when they didn't eat. And they don't have that mechanism in place anymore. Another thing is, smokers know how to end the meal. They take a cigarette. When they quit smoking and they don't have that cue anymore of just taking a cigarette at the end of the meal. And let's understand something. Some meals may have gotten cut short because they needed a cigarette. They couldn't smoke at the table, and the meal was going longer than, 15, 20 minutes. They went into withdrawal. They had to smoke to stop that meal. Without that cue in place, you will find some people, when they're quitting smoking, they may finish their plate. They may go finish another person's plate. They may go start another meal. They don't have a cue to end the meal. One suggestion that I do have for that is when people are done eating, just get up and go brush your teeth. It gets you away from the table. It gives you a clean taste in your mouth. It gives you your cue that you're done eating, and it's good oral hygiene. So there's a few things that people can do to try to get around that one behavior of, using a cigarette in the meal, finding something else to do it that doesn't have added calories involved. So anyway, the video will be probably, like I say, about a half an hour in length, and it will cover just general guidelines of what people can do to help control their weight when they're quitting, and maybe even lose weight down the road. You'll find many people who will say, they're smokers. They can't quit smoking. They're overweight. They can't lose weight. They're in bad relationships. They can't do anything about it. Hey, this is the deck they were dealt. This is who they are. When they make a change in an area, like quitting smoking, many people start to realize something about themselves, and that is, hey, if they get sick and tired of anything, they can do something about it. And that is where quitting smoking can become a stepping stone to make other major life improvements. Not what bad habits are replace it with now that I quit smoking. You may replace it with positive patterns. And one of those patterns may be a healthier eating style and being able to do more activity. And again, that's by default. You have the ability to do more once you quit smoking, in all likelihood, because of the improvements in your respiratory and circulatory systems. So you may find that you will make other improvements over your lifetime, which will actually help in weight down the line and help in overall health down the line. So anyway, the video will cover weight control issues. And again, I wish I could say it was as clear-cut as quitting smoking guidelines. See, because quitting smoking guidelines are really clear. Because all you got to do to succeed in quitting smoking, and again with weight, trickier, but all you got to do to succeed in quitting smoking is simply make one commitment and stick to that commitment to never take another puff. Only 3% of people who lose weight in our country are able to keep it off. That is a scary statistic. When people hear a number like that, they think, oh my gosh, if I'm overweight, I'm going to be that way the rest of my life. That's not what this number is saying. What it is saying is that the vast majority of people who try to lose weight in our country will fail. That's not because it's impossible to lose weight and keep it off. It's a technique that people use to try to lose weight and keep it off that generally is going to fail. It's going to undercut them. It's the same thing as if we say right now, quitting smoking by trying to cut down is close to impossible. It's basically a true statement. Most people who try to quit smoking by cutting down are not going to succeed. Now, that's not saying it's impossible to quit smoking. That's, of course, ridiculous, considering we have more former smokers in this country right now than current smokers. So again, the comment that people who try to quit by cutting down will fail is true, but that's not saying that it's impossible to quit smoking. Well, the same thing holds true with weight. The technique that most people use trying to lose weight are what's going to cause them to fail. It's not the impossibility of losing weight. It's the technique that people use trying to do it. When most people think about losing weight, they think about going on a diet. Well, think about it. What is a diet? A diet is a program that you go on to lose weight. Well, what happens when you lose the weight? Well, the basic plan is to get off the diet. Well, then you're going back to the old diet that you had that generally made you overweight to start with. So just the idea of going on a diet to lose weight is going to fail in most cases unless the people are willing to stick with that diet over a long-term process. So let's say a person starts a diet program. How do they know whether the program is working well for them or not? The way most people decide whether a program is working is they step on a scale to see if their weight is going up or down. The problem is a scale does not give a person a whole lot of information. A scale is telling them that their weight is shifting, but it's not telling them what their weight is. It's kind of like if I say a local grocery store has a big sale. They have 5 pounds for a dollar. Now, if they don't tell you what it is, that's pretty incomplete information. If you get to the store and find out that I was talking about steaks, hey, that could be a great deal. If you get to the store and find out I was talking about cat litter and you don't own a cat, this is worthless information to you. Just going by overall weight is not giving enough information of telling how well a person is doing with a weight control program. Actually, the term a person should be worried about when dealing with weight issues isn't weight control as much as it is fat control. Fat control is a matter of balance. It's trying to balance the amount of calories that we take in from food consumption against the amount of calories we burn off by doing activities. We all burn calories all day long, even when we're doing absolutely nothing. That is because we have what is known as our basal metabolic rate. That's how many calories we burn all day long, again, even when we're not doing any sort of activity whatsoever. Even when we're doing nothing, our heart is still beating, and we're taking a certain amount of energy to have our heart function. We're breathing. This takes a certain amount of energy. We have waste production going on. We have repair of cells. All these different activities that our body is carrying on requires energy, and we're burning calories all day long, maintaining these vital life functions. So the balancing act that we must do is to balance the amount of calories we take in to offset our basal metabolic rate plus any activity that we are doing beyond the basal metabolic rate. When we're sitting in a chair, we're spending more calories than if we're laying in bed. If we stand up, we're burning more calories than when we're sitting. If we walk around, we're burning more calories than when we're standing. If we start to jog, we're spending more calories than we would be if we were just walking. So all the activities we do take a little bit more and more energy. And again, the balancing act becomes, how do we balance the amount of food we consume against what we're burning off through our daily activities plus our basal metabolic rate? If we tip the scale and how much we burn off compared to what we are eating, we're going to alter the amount of fat and the amount of weight that our body is carrying. 3,500 calories is equal to 1 pound of fat. What this means is if you eat 3,500 calories more than you burn off, you're going to get a pound of fat. This isn't talking time frame. This is just saying 3,500 calories more over time will equal to 1 pound of fat over time. On the same basis, if you burn off 3,500 calories more than you consume, you will lose a pound of fat. So 3,500 calories is equal to 1 pound of fat, either on a gain or on a loss, depending on if it's being more consumed or more burned off. To illustrate what this means in practical terms, let's say a person just eats an extra 100 calories every single day as a reward for not smoking. Let's say they just take a little bit of food every day that they quit smoking as, again, a little reward for the fact that they made another day without a cigarette. Well, if a person stuck to a plan like this, in about 1 month, they would gain about a pound. Now, let's understand something. If a person steps on a scale 1 month to the next and they're up a pound, they're not going to be nervous. They're not going to think anything went wrong. A pound in a month? Oh, come on. That could be scale error. You can weigh yourself from day to day and alter a pound one direction or the other. You won't notice something went wrong. But let's say that you continue on that program and you do it for a year. Well, now we're talking about a 10.4-pound weight gain. That will become pretty obvious, although, again, it happened gradually over time. But let's say the person is really dense and doesn't notice that something really has gone wrong and sticks to this little game plan as their 100-calorie-a-day reward for not smoking. If they do that every day for 10 years, they're going to gain 104 pounds of fat as their reward for not smoking. So how much food does a person have to eat on a daily basis to gain 104 pounds over a 10-year period? Any one of these items would do it. A 10-ounce ginger ale, 2 chocolate chip cookies, 1 tablespoon of salad dressing, 1 tablespoon of butter, 1-ounce bag of potato chips, 1 medium piece of angel food cake. Any one of these items would do it. When I show this list to people in smoking clinics, I always kind of joke about it because they can recognize the list because they know that they're not just eating just the quantity of one of those items if they're not being careful. They're eating that entire list plus more with no problem whatsoever when they're first quitting smoking and, again, using food as a reward or using food as a substitution for cigarettes if they're not smoking. A little extra food eaten every day, again, on a daily basis, can turn into a lot of extra fat over time. The way this problem can be avoided is simply not to eat the extra 100 calories a day every day after you quit smoking, or, if you do, to pick up some activity, some exercise to offset the balance. If you're going to eat extra 100 calories, do an extra 100 calories of activity to try to burn off the difference.
So how much extra exercise would a person need to do if they were trying to burn off 100 extra calories? Well, that would take about 20 minutes of walking, 10 to 15 minutes of tennis, 10 minutes of stationary biking, 7 minutes of running, 10 to 15 minutes of swimming, or 11 minutes of jogging. This is where a lot of people who quit smoking, who do snack a little bit more, and then who do start exercising more, really start to miss the point of how much activity they have to do to burn off a relatively small amount of food. Let's consider a meal that some people would look at as a feast, a Thanksgiving kind of dinner. A person will sit down and have maybe a before-dinner drink, then they'll have a roll with some butter on it, then they'll have a salad with dressing on it, then they'll have, the main course will come, they'll have turkey, they'll have gravy on the turkey, they'll have potatoes, they'll have gravy on the potatoes, they'll have stuffing, they'll have other type of casserole dishes. More and more food coming, and they're just taking more and more of it, eating and eating to a point that they're not feeling good. They're stuffed. They've overeaten, and they've known it, and they realize, whoa, this is it. I'm done. Oh, wait, dessert comes, and now they have a pie a la mode, and they may even have another drink after dinner. I mean, they could eat a tremendous amount in the dessert after they've already done this huge feast. Now, most people, when they get to a point like this and now they finally do stop, will realize they've overeaten. Some people will now decide they better do something about it. And what they decide they should do is they should probably go do some exercise. And sometimes they'll even push themselves to do it. Some people will end up going out and maybe doing a 20 or 30 minute walk. And their logic at this point in time is they're doing this 20 or 30 minute walk to burn off the meal. That is what they are thinking. The reality of the situation, though, is a person going out for a 20 or 30 minute walk is not going to burn off the meal. They will burn off the calories that would be about the equivalent of the salad dressing that they had at that meal. They're not touching the main course. They're not touching the desserts. They're not touching the drinks. They are touching the quantity of calories, again, that was a salad dressing at that particular meal. This is not to say that people shouldn't exercise to help them lose weight. What it is saying, though, is people should eat food with a shovel and then expect a short walk or a short amount of exercise to offset the extra calories that they're taking in from a huge meal after eating. This can sound pretty discouraging to a person to think that just eating a little bit more every day can really cause a long-term weight gain, but the issue could be looked at in a reverse way. If instead of eating an extra 100 calories a day, a person interested in losing weight just gets rid of eating 100 calories a day that they used to eat and go for a 20-minute walk every day, it could have a long-term benefit, which is phenomenal. We're not talking about major life change here. We're saying get rid of 2 cookies that you may have eaten on a daily basis and go for a 20-minute walk every single day, and you could start to lose weight. Making those 2 changes, you could lose a pound in just about 2 weeks. The problem with this, though, is what will most people do with a program that they lose a pound in 2 weeks after doing all that activity, after getting rid of all that food, because that's how they're going to look at it. That's how they're going to say it. They got rid of 2 cookies every day. I mean, this is a great deprivation. They went for a 20-minute walk. This was a great inconvenience every day. And they did that for a 2-week period, and they're down a pound. What are most people going to think about a program like that? And more important, what are most people going to do with a program like that? They're going to chuck that program. They're going to think, I've done all this work. I've deprived myself of all this food, and all I did was lose a pound. Again, that's scale error. That's how people will look at a pound. The issue is, though, if they just were to stick with this program, and again, we're not talking about a major dramatic change here. We're talking about moderate changes that people can do over a long term with no risk. It's not like they're starving themselves. It's not like they're exercising themselves to death. If they do these 2 moderate changes in a program that they're willing to stick with, not a diet to lose weight, not an exercise program for when they lose weight, but just a program that they will stick with over the long term. If they make those 2 changes and they stick with the approach for a year, they could lose 26 pounds of fat in that year. For people wanting a faster weight loss, they could alter 500 calories a day. That would mean they'd have to get rid of 250 calories of food that they were eating prior and do 250 calories more of exercise. That would result in a net deficit of 500 calories, which would translate to about a pound a week, or 4 pounds a month, or again, 52 pounds over a year. So what would a person have to eliminate to get rid of 250 calories? Well, it'd be equivalent to one scoop of chocolate ice cream, one scoop of vanilla, chocolate sauce and a cherry, one martini, one pecan roll, 1/2 ounce of ice cream float, or 1/2 cup of fried onion rings. I always highlight the martini example and explain how I used to get people coming in my clinics at times bombed 5 nights in a row. I knew how they were handling not smoking. They're replacing one substance with another substance, which is dangerous to do even on non-addicted substances, but even more so when you're dealing with alcohol, which has an addictive potential. But even barring that issue, if we're just looking at the issue of calories involved, some people would recognize that, sure, it's a lot of extra calories. They better do something to offset it. Sometimes they'll even come up with lines like, they'll even walk to the bar. Well, let me show you how far that bar had better be to burn off the equivalent of the first martini. That bar had better be about 3 miles away, or 1 hour on a brisk walk, or, again, to burn off any of those foods that we were dealing with. We're talking about 20 to 30 minutes of running, 35 minutes of tennis, 20 minutes of stationary biking, 1 hour of leisurely cycling, or 20 minutes of racquetball. Again, I'm not saying to discount exercise and not do it because it's too much work. But people need to be cognizant of the amount of exercise they need to do to burn off an equivalent amount of food. Many diets aren't looking at calories, though. They're not looking at fat. They're basically looking at how to lose weight the quickest. And generally, a program that's going to make you lose weight quickly is not going to be one that is often going to have long-term success. Anytime weight loss is very quick, there's a pretty good chance that the diet is designed to help people lose water. You can lose water very quickly. You can gain water very quickly. This is an important note for smoking cessation programs because many people do get bloated the week they're quitting smoking. That effect can literally go into the second week where they're retaining fluid. That water weight will come off pretty quick, though, into that second week. But the general weight that people are concerned with when quitting smoking isn't that initial weight gain. It's not the bloating effect. It's weight gain that can go over a long-term period and have a very difficult time coming off. A program requiring moderate change, and again, likely to cause a slower weight loss, is much more likely to be a program that you will be able to stick with and a program that will have long-term results that are going to be beneficial for a person's overall health. There are three approaches a person can take to help them lose weight. One is they can diet. They can reduce the amount of calories they take in without changing their activity level. Another thing they can do is exercise more without changing their eating pattern. The third is a combination of approaches. Eating less calories overall and exercising a little bit more. The most effective technique for fat loss is a combination approach of cutting back a little bit on food while increasing activity. At one time, I had a nutritionist working in the stop smoking clinics that I was doing, putting together material to help people with weight loss. She had used this as an example. There was a study that was done where they were comparing the results that people were having who were either just dieting, who were exercising, or who were doing both. The three groups altered 500 calories a day. One group did it by eating 500 calories less food, getting rid of, again, a dramatic amount of food. The next group did it by increasing their activity level by 500 calories a day without changing the amount that they ate. The third group did 250 calories less food and 250 calories more activity. If the three groups of people compared notes with each other, the diet group would have realized they did better than the exercise group. If they just looked at weight, they would see that the diet group lost 11.6 pounds of weight, while the exercise group lost only 10.6 pounds of weight. The group who did the combination technique lost the most weight, though, 12 pounds. But the weight difference between those three groups was not very significant. What was significant is when you examine the fat loss between the three groups. Again, fat and weight are not interchangeable terms here. The amount of fat a person loses is the more important measurement of how well they're doing in a program to help improve their health. In these three groups, the diet group only lost 9.2 pounds of fat, while the exercise group lost 12.6 pounds of fat, and a group who did both lost 13.1 pounds of fat. When we were first only considering weight, it looked like the diet group outperformed the exercise group, but in reality, it was not the case. The exercise group lost a lot more fat, 12.6 pounds of fat, compared to the diet group, 9.2 pounds of weight. The group that ate less food and that did more exercise, though, lost the most fat overall, 13.1 pounds of fat. The difference here is, when looking at weight, when a person just loses weight, they may not be losing only fat. They may be losing water. They may be losing muscle mass. People who diet often, if they're starving their body, they can actually lose muscle mass at the same time they're losing fat, which is not a healthy approach for weight loss. Here we see how the diet group lost 11.6 pounds of weight, but only lost 9.2 pounds of fat, which means they lost 2.5 pounds of something else, which means they did lose water weight, and they very likely lost some lean body mass. The exercise group, on the other hand, lost only 10.6 pounds of weight, but they lost 12.6 pounds of fat. How that happens is they built up muscle, and of course, that's obvious. They exercise more and they build up muscle mass. Muscle weighs 5 times as much as fat. In fact, some people can go into an exercise program, start to look better, start to feel better. Their clothes may get loose on them, and then they'll step on a scale, gain weight, and get discouraged and throw away the program, thinking like, what's wrong? It's not working for them, when in fact it was working great. They were losing fat, they were getting healthier, but because a scale gave them a number, and again, these people were not analyzing what this number was, they judged the program to be ineffective, when in fact they were in a much better condition, they were in much better shape, and they had lost fat and were healthier because of the program they had done. Again, what is important to note here is a group that did the exercise and the dieting ended up losing the most fat. Even though they didn't gain as much muscle mass, they lost more fat than the other two groups, which means it was the most effective program for fat loss. When I'm talking about exercise, I'm not saying people need to go out and become marathon runners to be able to affect weight change. They can do little things now. They can take things that were a little bit easy and just make them a little bit harder. And doing this over a long-term basis can really help affect weight change. One thing, you can, like, go for a walk every day. And let's say you take a bus to work. Get off one stop before you have to, and walk the difference. The time differential may not be that great, and if you weigh yourself at the end of the day, there won't be a whole big difference. But you do that every day for the rest of your life, you can add up to a lot of extra calories burned off. If you drive, go for the furthest away parking place as opposed to the closest parking place. Again, the time differential may not be that great. In fact, it might be faster. You may not be wasting time looking for parking, but in the process, you'll burn lots of extra calories. Where walking, you'll burn 315 calories in a given time period. Sitting on that bus, you're only burning 95. Cycling leisurely, 255 calories, where if you were to drive in that same time period, you'd only be burning about 140. Well, I've had people look at that and say, well, I'll drive twice as far. Yeah, if you drive twice as far, you'll burn some calories, but it's not going to be giving you the benefits of the aerobic buildup that the cycling could have done. Using stairs, you'll burn twice as many calories as waiting for an elevator or an escalator. You can do things actually faster. Now, again, as a smoker, it didn't make sense to use stairs. It hurt. You'd get to the top and you couldn't breathe. But as an ex-smoker, you may very well have the ability to do this activity that would have hurt before. Doing dishes as opposed to using a dishwasher. Most of these other suggestions apply to almost anybody, but when it comes to smoking cessation programs, this last suggestion was for people in a smoking program. Doing dishes, it gives you something to do when you're done with the meal. As I said in the introductory part, you can get up at the end of the meal and brush your teeth. You could also get up and do the dishes. It's stopping further consumption of food. So while the calorie difference may not look a whole lot than using a dishwasher, the amount of food that you may stop eating by getting up and doing that activity may be tremendous. It may help very much so with controlling weight down the line. Some people may be convinced that their metabolism is going to alter and they're going to have to gain weight because they quit smoking. Well, let's say you're an individual whose metabolism does alter. What kind of activity can a person do to offset that metabolic change? For a person whose metabolism actually did slow down, and slow down significantly, if they were to do every other day a 300 calorie session, it should take about, again, half an hour, doing it 3 times a week, they would offset any metabolic benefit that smoking may have gave them for weight. If they want to reduce their risk of heart disease and improve their overall health, they should do these things within a certain target heart rate. That's where we start talking about aerobics. Aerobics means in the presence of oxygen. Aerobic fitness is your ability to take in, transport, and utilize oxygen. In other words, aerobic activities are activities that are going to require energy, endurance, and stamina. Smokers often have a hard time doing aerobic activities because they do impair their oxygen transport system. The carbon monoxide from tobacco smoke is poisoning the oxygen carrying capacity of the blood, making doing of aerobics for a person who is actively smoking a much more difficult process and in some cases a much more dangerous process. The way to calculate how much activity a person needs to do to be aerobic and to do it safely and getting a maximum benefit is they should be getting their pulse rate to 70 to 85% of its maximum. The maximum is calculated simply by age. You take your age and subtract it from 220. That would mean that if a person was 20 years of age and wanted to operate aerobically, they would learn to take their pulse as they're doing an activity and try to get their pulse rate up to 140 to 170 beats per minute. Again, if a person is 50 years old, we're dealing with a smaller number. They're only pushing their heart rate to 119 to 145 beats per minute. You want to try to do activities where you can monitor your pulse so you can see whether it's going up, how high it's going. If you're 40 years old and you're going 100 beats per minute, oh, pick up the pace a little bit. You can go a little bit harder. If you're 40 and your pulse is now 180 as you're doing the activity, slow down. You might be pushing it too hard. So you want to learn to be able to measure your pulse and to be able to keep it at this moderate level that's right for a person of your age. People can also lose weight by doing anaerobic activities, but anaerobic activities don't lend themselves to increasing overall cardiovascular fitness. Good aerobic activities are walking, running, swimming, cycling, rope jumping, aerobic dance. These are activities that you can work up doing a little bit more and more over time. Take your pulse during some of these activities. Make sure you're going within a safe heart rate. And activities, again, that you can do over an extended time period to help burn calories. Now, there are other activities that might be aerobics, things like tennis and racquetball and handball and calisthenics, basketball and volleyball. If you're running a court in basketball, if you're playing tennis and you're playing, you know, half hours straight, nonstop, no breaks, then it's aerobic. But if your game of tennis consists of hitting a ball back and forth for 5 minutes, sitting down and smoking a cigarette, no, this is not an aerobic activity. Once you're doing that break and smoking on top of it, you are getting very little aerobic benefits from that exercise. Smoking really does make it difficult for many people to do exercise. Although, I will get people in programs to say, oh no, they're very active. They do lots of exercise. But generally, when you hear these people, you will realize they're doing non-aerobic activities. Non-aerobic activities are things like weightlifting or sprinting or ballroom dancing or isometrics or softball. I love when softball season comes around and people say, oh, they're very active. They play softball twice a week. And again, as a smoker, they're just so amazed on how they can still do this activity. They can do softball, but analyze a game of softball. Half of the game, the person is literally sitting on a bench. The only time they get to run at all is if someone hits a ball when they're in the field, they get to chase after it. Or when they are at bat, if they hit the ball, they get to run around the bases. To be aerobic, you got to run 15 to 20 minutes nonstop. The only way you're going to turn softball into an aerobic game is if you separate the bases by 3 to 4 blocks each and you hit a home run. No one is going to play softball aerobically. It's not saying that it's not a fun activity. It's not saying that it's an activity that someone can do for enjoyment, but it shouldn't be their weight control program or their exercise program. It is not a program which is by itself building cardiovascular fitness. And then there are those smokers who do the low-intensity activities, bowling and golf. Analyze a game of bowling or analyze a game of golf. Bowling is where a person will pick up a 12 to a 16-pound ball, roll it down the alley, sit down, and have a beer. That beer, that first beer, is probably more calories than they're burning in the game of bowling altogether. And then golf, the way a lot of people play it, they hit a ball, and they get in a cart, they drive after it. If they're walking between the holes, they're burning calories. And that's a pretty good activity under that circumstance. But when they're driving between the holes, they're getting very little benefit aerobically. Even when walking between the holes, though, this is not going to be an aerobic activity because of the way golf is played. Generally, a person has to assess how far they're going to have to hit the ball. They're trying to figure out what kind of club they can use. They're looking over the terrain. They take a few deep breaths. They hit the ball. Then they analyze what they did. Then they will often slowly walk between the two holes and then repeat that activity. They're not pushing their heart rate to aerobic levels during that event. Again, these two activities might be fun, and these might be recreational activities, but there's other things that probably should be done to help supplement it if you're trying to do activities in a way to build up cardiac fitness. Some general guidelines. If a person is trying to build up an activity and do it aerobically, they should work with an exercise session format that looks like this, a warm-up of 10 to 15 minutes. Now, during that warm-up, they can do flexibility, muscle strength and endurance, whole-body movements. That is where a lot of smokers would quit, is what we'd normally consider the warm-up period. Then would come the aerobic of a vigorous sustained activity for 15 or 30 minutes, and then followed by a cool-down period. Again, another 10 or 15 minutes where they repeat the flexibility and whole-body movements. You don't want to do the muscle strengthening now because you're trying to give your heart a chance to recover here. This is really a cool-down period where you can do some activities, but nothing that's pushing your heart up to fast levels. For maximum benefit, the person should be doing exercise 3 to 4 times a week. I want to point out that doesn't say 1 to 2 times, but it doesn't say 5 to 7 times either. The heart is a muscle, and those in-between days is a process where the heart muscle can build itself up. It's healthier to do aerobics on an every other day cycle. You can do other activities in between those days, but not push your heart aerobically for the 15 to 20 minute time period, doing the same activities but not pushing your heart into the fast levels. You should be working 3 to 4 times a week, working at 70 to 80% of the maximum heart rate, and working out 15 to 20 minutes. As time goes on, you may even increase that level. If you want to burn more calories, you can go longer as you start getting stronger and stronger. One thing I want to point out, before you start going into aerobic activities, it would not be a bad idea to get checked out by your doctor. Let your doctor know you just quit smoking. If you've been inactive, let your doctor know you have not been active and you're now just thinking about getting back into doing exercise programs. If you're under 35, it wouldn't hurt to get a complete exam and get your doctor's advice. If you haven't been doing activity, especially if it's something new you're introducing, get checked out. If you're over 35 and now getting into exercise for the first time in a while, it wouldn't hurt to get that exam and try to get a stress EKG. You've been smoking. You've been smoking a long time. You might have underlying problems that you haven't pushed in a long time because it would hurt to do it, but it still may be there and still may be dangerous. So it's advisable to get checked by your doctor. Make sure everything is okay. And then, once safe, try to start to incorporate exercise into your lifestyle. It can really help. Quitting smoking has very likely given many people the ability to increase their activity, to increase their exercise, and again, to increase their overall well-being. When a person quits smoking, they've done probably the most powerful thing they can do to improve their overall health. But it doesn't need to stop there. They may find stopping smoking as a first stepping stone and do other activities that can help them with their weight, that can help them with their life. By quitting smoking, they've improved their heart efficiency, they've improved their ability to breathe. This allows them to be able to do activities longer that they very likely could not have done before or done as well. To be able to do these activities for the rest of their life more efficiently, it's still a matter of just sticking to the personal commitment that they made the day they stopped smoking, to stick with that commitment over the long term, to never take another puff.